You guys, hello. I'm Guy Brandon, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show pinging over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and everything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Oh,
very muted
journalist
this week.
Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. Academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hello, Guy. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
How was your Halloween?
My Halloween was fine. I didn't have as good of a time as I should have. As a gay man, it's your obligation to take the most advantage of it, but I think I was slightly sick. Every week, we start the show by taking a question from our listeners about our own pop culture tastes. This week, I want you guys to tell me, which website do you visit the most? Winner.
Oh, no, they didn't, is what it's called. It's a live journal site. I don't know how they make money, but I've been reading it since I was 23 years old, and I read it like 8, 9, 10 times a day. It's just the gossip is always aggregated and curated the right way. I know they're going to hit a topic right when I need it. And the community itself, the comments inside the community, you get to know people and people evolve and come and go. But the comments make the whole thing.
Well curated gossip.
Yes.
Gossip is hard to find these days. Like Perez Hilton has passed his best day. TMZ is doing what it's doing. But, like, I kind of just want to be able to look at a website and know what are people up to.
And be snarky and just and see lots of pictures and have it load heavy. But TMZ is all about virals now, so that's real sad.
Yeah. Margaret.
I'm not loyal to any one particular website. I have to say I just go onto Twitter or Facebook and just jump off of what people are posting that's interesting to me. But, I mean, this is probably a very boring answer, but I do get the New York Times headlines every day in my inbox, and I do often read everything on the New York Times, or at least like click on it and just read the first couple paragraphs. But, you know, lately I've been noticing that I've been pulled into a lot of fusion pieces. Like, they just have a good handle on writing pieces about snarky snarky issues and social justice issues in a way that's light and funny and provocative at the same time. Like today with the fact that Anonymous was leaking all of those KKK names, alleged KKK members. Fusion had some really good roundups about that, just like, you know, what these different politicians were saying, you know, if it really is credible at all, so forth. So, yeah. I've been impressed with them lately.
Oliver, what about you?
Well, if you had asked me this question a week ago, the answer would have been very easy. It would have been Grantland.com. But, of course, ESPN just pulled the plug on it at the end of last week. And, I mean, I'm really bummed. As someone who – it really was easily the site that I went to the most. It was the very first thing that I read every morning. And I just had such immense admiration – well, I still do. It's not like I shouldn't use past tense for the writers. Like, I have such immense admiration for so many writers there. I mean, partly the site brought on a lot of people that I already knew. A lot of them were old friends and colleagues. But it's really the writers that I discovered through them that really made me appreciate how great and the collection of talent there. So everyone from Andy Greenwald on television to Zach Lowe in the NBA to Jason, a.k.a. Network Concepcion, who still writes from the funniest things I've ever read on that site.
Strong.
You know, Danny Chow in basketball, Bill Barnwell on NFL. I mean, I could go on and on. Molly Lambert.
Yes, Molly.
And now it's all gone. And those folks, most of them will probably land someplace really well. I mean, Rembert Brown is now at the New York Magazine. You know, a bunch of folks are joining Bill Simmons at his yet-to-be-named new project, and maybe some of the old writers will end up back there as well. But, I mean, for financial – I don't know. I'm not one to second-guess why corporations make the decisions they do. All I know is that Grantland had a remarkable thing going, and I'm so thankful for the 4 years that it was around, and I think it sucks that they had the rug pulled up from under them.
Like, it is very interesting when a creative corporation you love – dies or is smashed apart or just simply loses everybody. And then the weird way that the synergy is lost and you can have things. I mean, LucasArts picked up a lot of what had been Infocom and it made Grim Fandango and a lot of fun things. But, you know, a game company that I loved so much when I was a kid just disappeared, and loss of voice is really hard.
Yeah. And the thing that occurs to me right this moment is that I've seen other publications that I used to love fade away and disappear. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes you saw the fade happen.
I mean, sure.
You got to mourn
Stop
it over
posting,
the course.
Posting, yeah. Believing.
Just a quality fall, you know, sure. Falls the hell off. I mean, the Village Voice would be one example. It's not gone, but it kind of is gone. You know, the San Francisco Bay Guardian, which is where I cut my teeth.
There was a time All when weeklies, Salon basically. Was good.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so many different, especially hip-hop and music magazines. But you could see the writing on the wall coming from a long distance. And even though once Bill got fired by ESPN, you kind of knew Grantland's days were probably numbered. But this still felt abrupt. It wasn't like the site was bad or had been bad. It was still doing great and then gone. And that, to me,
Chris Connelly's out of a job again.
I think whenever I see a website that's basically fundamentally about long-form articles, I'm just watching the clock. I really am. I'm like, it's only – nothing golden can stay when it comes to long-form. It's sad.
Sad.
But if you give somebody a listicle that's hard to click through and has facts that we all already know,
right.
That's going to be monetizable. You guys, the website I visit the most is Wikipedia. There's nothing
– Oh, I do love Wikipedia.
The amount of time that I will just spend – look. Sunday morning, I was not feeling great. There had been a German kid at the party, and he wasn't from Hamburg, but I was like, guy, why don't you learn the history of Hamburg? And then once you start from there, you learn about the idea of a Grossberger, like a Grossberger, one of the people who gets to vote within the city of Hamburg, and you start moving from there. You start reading the big Grossberger
wow.
families and learn how they affected other cities.
Whoa.
And, you know, it's a great way to have brunch without friends.
Sounds like a good hangover cure.
Have you ever participated in a Wikipedia edit-a-thon?
Ooh.
Oh, no, I have not.
You should get on that. They do a lot here in L.A. because one of the main people who leads it is in Los Angeles. And you can, instead of just reading Wikipedia, you can contribute to it.
I'm scared of that. There's only one Wikipedia entry that I will alter other than my own. And I haven't edited my own
You're
in
like
Gilmore
Girls. You're not allowed to alter your own.
It is just it is a Dutch liqueur called Advocaat. And I have a strong opinion about why it is called Advocaat.
So you've been bombing the Advocaat wiki page is what you're saying?
Basically, there's a troop of people who think that it is named after lawyers because it was liked by lawyers because that's the Dutch word for lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Advocate.
But the real story.
But the real story is that it was made with avocados in the Dutch colonies in Recife. And then when they lost Recife to the Portuguese, they went back and they made it with like an egg custard because it was the same
Ew.
Thing.
Egg custard liqueur?
It's an egg custard liqueur. It is cum. Like it is just...
Oh my God!
It is just...
My throat immediately coagulated.
Alcoholic
Thank you
cum.
For that.
Thanks to In Turnaround and the Max on Reddit group for that question. Who knew it would go so horrible so quickly?
Wow. Nicely done there, guy.
Coming up in this week's show.
I know
show,
what I'll be having for eggnog this season.
Coming up in this week's show, a look at what's new and good in late night. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news and events have got our attention this week. Margaret Whopper, what are you all about?
I dived into The Leftovers season Ooh. 2. Mm. Have you guys been watching this at all?
Mm-mm.
No, but it is described to me by coworkers.
Okay, in a loving way or not so much?
In a skeptical way. Like, yeah. Their assertion is not enough people died for it to really matter.
Oh. Well, I mean, again, I'm jumping in season 2, so in a way, I'm just impartial. I watched the first 3 episodes of season 2 because I kept hearing that it was really good and that it was different from season 1, which didn't... I tried to tune into once or twice, and it just didn't pull me in. But season 2 so far, I mean, it's Damon Lindelof. This is his show. And it's laying out just as many chips, I feel like, as Lost ever did, which
oh,
is
really?
Making me nervous because I'm like, dude, this kind of bit you in the ass last time that you didn't quite make all these things sew up. But at the same time, I'm also a person that doesn't mind when things just go loose and wild and it doesn't get all tied up. Like, that's fine. As long as it's entertaining, I really don't care. But it shifts each episode so far from which family they're talking about. Mm. And the first one starts with this family called the Murphys, which the wife of the family is played by Regina King, who is always fantastic.
Yeah.
And they have that kind of perfect, like, on the surface, everything seems cheery and bright and regular life people. And then there's just these strange things about them that get revealed over the episode. So I mean, basically, so far to me, it seems like it's taking this world of chaos that came about from, you know, 2% of the population disappearing for no discernible reason, and then just seeing how that makes people react, all mm-hmm. different types of personalities. And I have to say, I like that sort of like that sort of test for people. Like, what would you do if 2% of the population disappeared? What would that mm-hmm. other person do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, just being exposed to some taste of the unexplainable. Like, we have so many shows that are zombies or, you know, gigantic things, but having just some small taste of the unexplainable put into your world and having to wrap your head around that is very compelling.
Yeah, and there's a whole, like, biblical angle to it, of course. Like, people who think it has something to do with, you know, the rapture. And, yeah. I mean, that it basically was the rapture. So that pulls me into, like, just seeing the kind of the a-religious people versus the completely religious zealot portion of the people.
Who here watches Walking Dead?
I do.
Oh, I heard that they did a whole episode of Walking Dead with, like, no zombies, that it was all just the weird cultists who run in.
This season?
Yes. I don't know what I'm talking about.
They do that often because you get tired.
Understandable. When are we all about this week?
Ash versus Evil Dead premiered this weekend on Halloween. Mm. And if Ash versus Evil Dead is a TV series based on the Evil Dead series, which is Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, which is basically just Evil Dead with more money, and then Army of Darkness. And so Ashley is back. Ashley's like pushing 60. He's a scumbag, but like lovable. And he lives in a trailer park, and he this is why I love this entire thing, this whole universe. He reawakens the demon by getting high with a hoe and trying to seduce her by reading the
her lines on her palm.
No, reading the the Book of the Dead,
oh.
The Necronomicon, reading the chant. So he got really stoned and read it on accident. Always a bad idea. But it's hilarious. It's hysterical. He's got some like minor characters in there, but it's really his show. And the show was totally set up. So it's Ashley. And Ashley can go – it's already been picked up for a season 2, but Ashley can sort of evolve as a character, and all these people kind of sort of flock to him. But what I love about Bruce Campbell's character as Ashley is that he has come back and he has aged exactly how you would think that Ashley would have aged given everything that he's been exposed to. It's pretty adorable. Still the same quirk and charm and the I got you kind of character with the, like the finger guns, but then also just cooler than – the next person closest to him.
So two questions. Mm-hmm. Number one, is Sam Raimi involved?
He's all over the credits.
Okay.
He's all over the. And then there's some now like ancillary Raimis popping up in the credits. So like there's some of those too, but it's good.
And if you never watched the Evil Dead trilogy, will this make any sense?
I'm glad you brought that up, Oliver, because they do a thing where he kind of tells everybody if you've never mm-hmm. like seeing the movies, how it all started. And it goes back to how Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, Evil Dead 2 was made with more money. And basically they were like, it's just the Evil Dead, because Evil Dead was a student picture that was released theatrically. So like I noticed that they intercut Evil Dead 1 and 2 and then threw in Army of Darkness. But I can like it basically gives you like a real tight, like 30 years ago, my friends and da da da. So yeah, you can catch up with it. And with the quirky Raimi stuff, like his special effects, he's really dedicated to sort of live effects versus CGI. So he makes great use of all of that still.
Nice.
I love it.
I don't like horror.
I know you don't.
Oliver, what are you all about
you
this
tricked
week?
Us pretty well
yeah,
last
you
week.
Did.
No, there's something like... Oh, I watched like half of The Exorcist on Halloween and like half of Blade Runner, and both of them like
Blade Runner.
I don't know why it was being shown particularly. It was just moody as fuck, and I've mm-hmm. still never seen the whole mm-hmm. thing, but it's just so compelling. Oliver, what are you all about this week?
So let's see. My mini about would be the end of baseball season, but the beginning of basketball season. So shouts out to the Kansas City Royals. It was a really fun series.
You can't make it a mini about. This is the first time I've ever actually cared about a professional sporting event ever.
Why?
And I want because. There are no dads involved. Like, there's no judgmental dad being mad at me for not doing it right.
Okay.
It was just my friend Ryan would make me come over and watch Royals games with him because he's from Kansas City.
Yeah.
And then I found myself in situations when I was not with him, like glancing up at a game and being engaged or like checking from work. And it really was like that 14-inning first game
yes.
was amazing, and I had stuff that I needed to do, but I could, like, I had a show, and I was like, I'm going to be late because I'm going to finish this. And then last night, I mean, Jesus Christ, like, what looked to be a, oh, we're just going to have to take this loss for the Royals.
Right.
Like, that one play with Duda's fucked up throw.
Yep.
Like, just changed everything. It was wonderful.
It was a really fun series considering that it only went five games. But, I mean, every game, almost every game except for maybe game three was wildly entertaining. And mostly it was because the Royals kept coming back from behind.
Right.
Like, so, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I'm enjoying the beginning of NBA season. I'll probably come back and talk about it later. The main thing that I really liked in the last week was I finally got to watch The Martian. And I kind of probably went in expecting to like it. But it certainly at least met, if not exceeded, my expectations. I really love that film.
There's something so 19th century about an American, about it being such a process, like such a process-oriented movie. That, like, it is about this person having to answer problems and with, you know, with industrial
with
skill.
Ingenuity.
Yeah.
With freeze-dried poo, basically.
But, well, do not spoil it.
Yeah.
Okay. I need to see the poo. I need to see the poo for myself. Oh,
but why do you love it in ways that won't offend Margaret?
I like nerdy sci-fi films.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I like sci-fi action, too, but I like a good, like, really nerdy sci-fi, you know, the scientific part of sci-fi. I mean, when's the last time you saw JPL being, like, prominent in a movie?
Oh, nice.
Like, yeah, like never.
And Heroes. I
mean, yeah.
Did you have a problem with the stunt castiness of some of the choices there?
Like what comes to
Donald Glover. Faison. Donald Faison would have been
Donald Glover.
Donald Glover and a little bit Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, well, the thing with Wiig is it just – she didn't seem like a good fit for the character. And I don't know. Hers is sort of a thankless task, and I just didn't feel like it worked.
A woman who asked how things would work. Like, it was
–
well, she's a PR person, so she's always she's worried about the
Yeah. So she was like the lawyer in Jurassic Park.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, again, damn.
Thankless.
Correlation.
It's a really thankless role, and Wiig did not seem
to
be like –
why would she bother with that?
I don't know.
Because Matt Damon's –
it's prominent, though.
Yeah, okay.
It's prominent, but it's not a great role.
Is that saying that she wants to make a little transfer into more serious roles?
I don't know, because it wasn't a great dramatic role. You know, I could have done with a little bit less Jeff Daniels. I thought Donald Glover, it's fine. I'm fine with that.
Isn't there some kind of whitewashing, too, of one of the main characters?
There was a little bit, but, the main JPL guy was Chinese-American, and then they had
– I think it was actually a little bit noteworthy for taking characters who were written as white and casting them as non-white.
Well, there's two Asian characters that I believe were not cast as Asians, and people were upset about it.
Yeah. Well, the lead character was played by the lead – NASA guy who's not Jeff Daniels, 12 Years a Slave.
Chiwetel Ejiofor?
Thank you. I need to learn how to pronounce his name. But his character is supposed to be half black, half Indian.
In the book, he's just a South Asian.
Yeah,
but
I think they kind of flipped him into sort of like half, but he doesn't look remotely South Asian at all. So whatever. I mean, it's fine.
Yeah.
They kept the name at least. So I didn't think the casting, that wasn't a real issue for me. If anything, the movie ran just a little bit long. Like, they could have lopped off maybe 10, 15 minutes here and there. I mean, it's a 2.5-hour movie.
I'm so sick of that.
Like,
my wife is with you on that.
Yeah, tired of that
2 hours.
Just find a way.
Also, is it so much to ask that, like, our film productions be able to just do the work of figuring out what a last name means and, like, being appropriate with it, sort of like being able to understand from context clues when somebody is supposed to be South Asian or something.
So I can't – again, I'm not one to defend their casting choice. I didn't really remember that part of the backstory. It did strike me odd that he's supposed to be playing, you know, a mixed race character. I'm like, yeah, but you don't remotely look the part. So what's that supposed to be about? I mean, for a film in which it's like it really does feel like if Matt Damon in Interstellar, that was like bad Damon. This is like the good Damon side of it. But it's like kind of the same character. Like, you were marooned on a planet by yourself.
Yeah.
Didn't you just make this movie, except you're not psychotic now? So, but that said, again, I really liked it. I super enjoyed it. Best Ridley Scott film in a long time, which is probably not saying much.
My mini All About, we already discussed, which is me being very having had a lovely time with the World Series and kind of caring about a sport for the first time, it felt charming.
We should go to the Spring Street Smokehouse in Chinatown and have burnt ends, which are a KC barbecue specialty.
That would be absolutely lovely. But my major All About is two-parter, kind of. First of all, there was a great article in The Atlantic that I only saw today. I think it came out this week that was basically about, I think it was called like The Decay of Twitter or something.
Yes, that was a good article.
Fascinating
article.
But the assertion that the problem with Twitter is that we have not been able to figure out the space that it occupies between oral interaction and literary interaction, that people are using it as transitive, fun, like verbal communication, but then it is being taken by others and interpreted as declarations of well-considered like opinion, mm-hmm. has created a dangerous zone with it. And that's what's made it less fun than Instagram or Snapchat or some of these other things. And I was wondering what your thoughts on that were. Did you guys read it?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Was it on The Atlantic or was it on Medium?
It was definitely, thank God it was on The Atlantic because I wouldn't have read it.
Okay. I just, for some reason, I was thinking it was like on Matter, you know, that one site that's part of Medium. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure. But you can just cut that, Colin.
No, keep that.
I thought it was a really insightful piece because it got at the problems of Twitter in terms of like letting bullying stand as so much a part of the culture. Yeah. But I just feel like there's no other sector of like popular culture where you could just be that abusive on a regular basis and like the, you know, scorekeepers of it, the sort of gatekeepers of the thing let you do that. So that I thought was really insightful. You know, as far as like the way people are using it, I mean, the thing that I love about Twitter is the way that some people are kind of like corrupting it. Like there are a lot of poets and fiction.
Zola.
Well, definitely.
The second part of my All About is Zola the same week as that, showing what's amazing about Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that people are finding this way to string these like long form stories in Twitter bursts and these poets who also just use it to make these really super compressed, like crazy little micro poems.
But the only problem with that is that she'll never be able to replicate that success. So
apparently she's been typing up those kind of stories for some time, and this was just the one that exploded.
Well, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how that happens. But the reason why only a certain group of people found it is because what the article stated, and this is what I completely agree with, is that it's factioned off into so many little micro sects.
Yeah.
It's factioned off into these little sections that it's hard to make it one cohesive place. And it's like you're shouting. It's literally like you're shouting into a hallway and no one's answering.
And sometimes people answer. And it takes Michael Jackson dying or something like that for it to turn into one space. And for the Golden Globes, it does. For like certain moments. I mean, one of the greatest moments for me, like my discovery of Black Twitter, was being like, what the fuck? Eve's Bayou is trending? And then just realizing...
Yes!
Eve's Bayou was playing on BET.
Yeah.
And it was like people were forming a community and it was lovely to go and watch and participate. And it was super fun. And you can sort of create ad hoc moments and ad hoc communities. Mm-hmm. One time there was just a Lindsay Lohan movie on and I live tweeted it. And like people got really active
into
and participatory
it.
And it was fun. We don't all have the time for that every day. But I do think that Zola being able to so perfectly understand this space in between, like that the charm of it is that it will feel like it's just somebody telling you a dirty, saucy story.
Yeah.
But she will give it all of the composition of essentially Magic Mike for girls.
Should we just briefly recap for our listeners who don't have no idea what Zola's about? You want to just recap it?
Oliver, I'll let you recap it.
Okay, so she's a stripper in Florida who goes on a trip with a white stripper who ends up being a call girl prostitute, which the Zola didn't realize. And basically the story opens with, this is how I dumped a quasi friend. And she goes into this whole long extended narrative that involves the white stripper / prostitute, her boyfriend, her pimp, and then random Johns and some other people.
The lady who owned
jumps
the condo
off a balcony at some
and
point.
Counted money like a rich lady.
And there's all sorts of like double crossing going on.
And also just like how much Zola represents prostitution best practices throughout this entire thing.
Yes, her rules.
And it's just sort of like, what the fuck is this woman? Like she never prostitutes at any point in time herself.
But she knows how to.
She just goes in. It's like one of those shows where somebody fixes your restaurant. She just goes in to Jessica's life and is like, hey, let's have a conversation about why you should charge more than $100 for the pussy.
Zola Savaho. That's should be your new nickname.
The Atlantic article was super great, and like I really respected. I feel like with so much digital media, people don't think in a nuanced fashion about the way that like human culture is being applied to this thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even back in the day at the beginnings of World of Warcraft, me trying to have a conversation with people about the way that friend groups will, once one big MMO is picked, that MMO will remain dominant forever.
Right.
Because that's how human beings work. Mm-hmm. Like figuring out how human culture and human behavior fit in with these weird new ways of expressing ourselves. It's fascinating.
Not to bury the lead, though, but the point of the article was to say that the reason why Twitter has maxed out with its user base and is likely on a decline is because it can't solve this conundrum, which is that people want to use it to banter, but other people treat it as if there being, you know, hard-line political statements already being made. So what's the resolution to that? Or maybe there's not. I mean, the only suggestion the article had was you would have more kind of private tweets or private group settings, sort of similar to how – in Facebook, you have friends, public, and different layers.
Well, they – go ahead.
No, I want to hear the digital strategist.
Well, the biggest problem is that they built the model based on popularity. So from the very beginning, it was more followers you have versus you, that's how powerful your voice is. So then it became a commodity to say something and have it be received. The problem is that we don't know really – to what extent engagement and reach really matter, because we're not getting the same life cycle on a single tweet. You know, people aren't getting paid that same amount of money anymore. It's not effective. And also,
if you're craft, you'll just pay a Vine star to make a Vine about craft.
Exactly. And that's the thing that they can't seem – their model is – I say this about every company that's falling apart, but your model is flawed. The fact that you can't monetize tweets until you get to this echelon.
The model is new. The model is new, and the difference between are you going to be Friendster, who what Facebook gave us was just better Friendster after we had a beautiful 5 years with MySpace.
Right.
A chaotic 5 years.
I miss like, MySpace sometimes.
Are you going to be able to hold on long enough that your business will be able to adapt? And I do think Twitter is at a really weird, hard point. And also part of it is I think we need to grow up. There was something so interesting about it saying the same forces that allow it to move so rapidly to support a Bernie Sanders campaign or take down a government in the Middle
Tactical
East.
Tactical Twitter, right.
Are also the things that make these very destructive, like, aggressive trolling actions. I have so much trouble with the word bullying.
Why?
Because I like the First Amendment and everybody's right to say everything, because it's like identifying so much as a gay guy, like that we were such outsider voices for such a long time. And from a legal perspective, we could be stopped from saying things because we were encouraging people to commit an illegal act.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concept of regulation of speech to appropriate speech, I always think will just be the existing power structure reinforcing itself. And so I worry about the ways we talk about unacceptable speech. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I agree with you on that one.
It does, but then I have to say that doesn't really leave room for, like, harassment. You know what I mean? Like, people who are vulnerable to doxing and attacks and personal vendettas and all the rest.
But it's the double-edged sword of those same anonymous dudes who sometimes are going after the rapist who got protected, are then also sometimes going after Anita Sarkeesian.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do with that. And there's always just the fact that I am still a Caucasian man, and deep in the heart of every Caucasian man is a libertarian, because things are mostly okay. and so
Rand Paul would be happy to
hear. Yeah. He wants to meet you today.
All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk late night after this.
My name is Jennifer, and I'm from Bethel Park, PA. And I listen to Bullseye because I was brought up on Top 40 Music and Bland Media, and Bullseye makes me more culturally aware. And when the segment is with someone whose work I don't know, I always get drawn in, and I'm glad I'm listening.
I'm Jesse Thorne. We'll talk to novelist Margaret Atwood and comedian Matt Bronger on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I am your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And one of the very first things we talked about on this podcast so many months ago was the changing face of late night. This was a period of time when a lot of people were leaving and there was a lot of speculation about who would take over what. And now things have fallen into their places. And we still have a whole lot of
white
Caucasians on most of the network, on all of the networks and most of cable. We have only men. And we have an astounding number of Jameses.
Besides James Corden, who's the other James?
Jimmy Fallon.
Oh, I'm not thinking of him as a true James. Okay.
There's one more James. Because when they did that cover on GQ, they were like, it's three Jameses, but I forget who the third
Jimmy
one.
Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, there you go.
So, like, with things...
You would hate to know that we just did that.
With things having rolled out and, you know, Trevor Noah and Stephen Colbert, like, solidly into their runs, who's working for you, who isn't, and has your relationship to late night changed over the course of the past 3 or 4 years?
Well, if you had asked me about Stephen Colbert's show the first night after I saw the opening episode, I would have said, oh, he's in trouble. It felt so awkward. It felt like he was really uncomfortable not having his crutch of being the kind of persona that he'd created over the years for Comedy Central. But now I think he's really found his groove with the show.
It's the best goddamn show in late night.
Yeah. I mean, it's really stellar. I mean, and I have to say, I think that Stephen Colbert is a pretty fantastic interviewer. Like, I enjoy watching him interview people. He is just a dick enough to ask tough questions. Mm-hmm. And that's important in that role because you can't all be, like, jokes and jabbing elbows. You have to have some kind of, like, grit to it. Like, Hillary Clinton, I just was watching him interview her, and he asked her some really good questions like, you know, do we really want the 90s back? Are you basically going for a third term for Obama or your husband? And, like, those are really... really important questions to catch her on and see what she says.
In preparation for this, I watched one episode of Everybody, and I was surprised by how much I did actually appreciate Fallon. That however much Fallon isn't the comic voice I love most, I love his understanding of what a talk show is. Like, that a talk show is a light and breezy cocktail party as people go off to sleep. My only problems with him, and God knows his bits get that, like his segments, I mean, not so much the games with celebrities, but like there was questions and dancers where you have to, like, it's man on the street, but they have to dance at that point in time while they're saying the stuff. And it's like, that's perfect. Like, that is exactly what a late night show should be. The problem is always that he is in third gear. He's never selling it truly. And that he is so nice. Like, he's just so nice. Like, Stephen Colbert, among other things, you just know will push back. That he is an interviewer who's going to get something for you. And it's amazing. Winter.
I was about Jimmy. I think that Jimmy really has, for me, I think he can translate to young people. Young people are drawn to him. And that's, I'm not saying that's why he got the job. I'm saying that that's what makes him an effective late night host. But God, Conan really occupied that space well when he was late night. And it was late night, right? But and he just got done in so dirty by NBC that he's like a shell of his former
self. I mean, he's just
languishing
on TBS at this point, right?
But it's an interesting commentary on change in our culture. That in the like late 1990s, the thing that appealed to young people was this sort of like edgy, absurdist alt comedy. And the thing that we identify as being appealing to younger people now is Jimmy Fallon's niceness. But that he is – the thing is like he's not going to hurt or break any YouTube stars that are on there. But also I don't know why I would watch two people being just charming and cute with each other. We're just so cute.
I know. And it's aggressive and it can be like super saccharine. But the one thing that Johnny Carson was amazing at, and even when I watched him and I was like 3 years old watching Johnny Carson, like appointment viewing, is that he knew how to bring on talent that would appeal to me. So like the Drew Barrymores, the Emmanuel Lewis's, the Gary Coleman's, and interact with them like an adult with somebody who's he felt like is on his level. He never like really sugarcoated. He would try to, and they would give it back to him. He knew how to play with his guests.
He had just a little bit of a tough guy edge, and a little bit of a straight man deal too.
So he let his guests kind of, you know, and then he would come and do the Carsoni thing. Jimmy, I think he just understands what his audience is looking for. So, like, the Empire skits are some of my favorite. When he does skits that are based on real shows, I find that that's really smart.
I feel like he is trapped in the job that he has.
He
becomes electric when he gets to act or do impressions.
Yes, he gets playful and he gets exuberant. But yeah. when he's like in an interview, it just isn't his.
He doesn't want to deliver jokes. Like, he doesn't want to deliver jokes and he does a terrible job of it. Seth Meyers gives you 15 goddamn minutes of jokes to open up this show. And I admire and respect that. They are such well-written jokes, but they're
highbrow.
It's highbrow, and I like highbrow jokes. It just isn't setting up a party.
Right.
It's like, how do you pivot from that to being able to be charming and engaging?
Yeah, exactly.
And hey, I like intellectual show-offs, but Stephen Colbert is able to, and also it's the difference between Stephen Colbert gives you 4 or 5 jokes. He gives you one bit that is like open and breathes. There, nothing breathes in the first like 15 minutes of Seth Meyers' show. Mm-hmm. Oh, I also should have said at the beginning, I regularly work in the late night field, so that will to some extent impact the things that I say. And I also shouldn't be saying, look, I mean, these are the opinions that I have, but I would willfully work for any of these people. And also, I think that they are great shows. But like, you look at Corden, who comes from a way less jokey place, but he has been able to find the things that work to his strengths and work to his like vaudeville-y show busy strengths, but also integrate and pull in like random people in the street and his guests so that you get this relationship. I think Seth Meyers can really miss that relationship.
Why can't I get into James Corden then? I've never seen one episode. I've never looked at his show once. I miss David Letterman. I really miss David Letterman.
I mean,
so it's hard for me to get into Colbert.
It's possible he's just not for you. I mean, he definitely doesn't have the edge of a Letterman, but he is just so charming and affable and available. What are our thoughts on Trevor Noah?
Trevor Noah, I think, is really charming, actually. More charming in person on the TV than I thought he would be. Like, I was expecting him to be kind of a lightweight. And in some ways, he is. Like, I do think that as an interviewer, for instance, like, he does not know what he's doing yet.
Yeah.
Like, I watched him interview, the young actress who's in The Room. What is her name?
She was in Trainwreck, anyway.
Oh, yes. She plays Amy Schumer's sister in Trainwreck. So he's interviewing
Brie Larson.
Brie Larson, yes. So he's interviewing Brie Larson, and he just could not think of things to ask her. Like, about 3 or 4 times, he was like, this movie is just, it's really special. Like, it's really good. Like, he just, you know, didn't, I mean, she made the most of it because she kind of was fun and playful and had things to say, but.
How do you not go into an interview not having questions to ask? Like, I don't get that.
Well, I mean.
I don't know.
His producers should have given him enough questions. The question is he not, like, is he inexperienced enough at interviewing that he ran through all of his questions very quickly that he lost track of something? Or, and part of it, I think, the big problem with Trevor Noah and one of his potential strengths is that he is divorced from American culture. So he does not have the natural visceral reaction to these people that you maybe do when they are part of the culture that you've been engaged in engaging with.
Mm-hmm.
Even just like from like a Jon Stewart place of if she had been in a movie with Amy Schumer, he could talk to her about that.
Yeah, I do want to just say, though, about Trevor Noah that I do think he has potential. I really do. I think there's something about him that, like, there's something magnetic and interesting there.
That he is stylistically so different from Jon Stewart.
Yes,
he's really
and
valuable.
I love his accent. I can listen to his accent all day.
Well, it's the two things of he alone among people who took over sort of, like, existing shows is getting to come just get into the driver's seat of a really well-oiled machine.
Yeah.
Like, when you hear those bits, they are just as well-written now as they were 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
But his accent is so pretty, but it means that he does not have nice, snappy, stand-up, like, American stand-up comedian delivery. He's got this very pronouncey delivery that is interesting to listen to but has a different energy. But there, with him, it was, again, like, when he was being loud at the beginning of the show, that's not his natural place. Like, his one-person shows where they sort of, like, calm conversationally, I will toss out a joke here and we will move past it.
Yes.
and he's trying to occupy that. Yeah, we got a great show.
He needs a little more fire, like a little more gravitas and grounding.
It was somebody's show for so long.
When they hit those points when he is able to make a little joke about growing up in South Africa, that's when it really is like you see the potential. Oliver, I've been steamrolling forever.
No, it's fine. But I mean, John Oliver was able to step into that and rock it. And I'm sure there's a story behind why Samantha Bee either turned down the job or wasn't offered the job. I want to know what that is because I think she would have killed it as the replacement. And
She's got her own show coming.
I know. And maybe that's it. She's been doing The Daily Show for such a long time. But if there was going to be an ideal steward to be able to take over for Stewart, I think Sam would have been fantastic at that.
One of the things that is just so stunning is that The Daily Show managed to lose the top five replacement possibilities in such rapid succession immediately before he left. That is ridiculous and crazy. And you also – I mean, the logical assumption is that Comedy Central – as a place that was, we present advertisers with men. We give you men. You can advertise male deodorant here. Mm. Like, just at that point in time, wasn't interested. And then I feel like in the past year or so, we've really figured out, like, well, a million people are going to watch your show. So getting as many eyes as you can matters. And also them having, like, two series Crazy Pop with female, predominantly female cast, and another period doing all right.
What about The Nightly Show? Because that's another one that, again, like, it should be for me, and I just can't get into.
Look, I love The Nightly Show, and part of the reason that I love The Nightly Show is they are so good about letting me be on it. But I feel like Larry Wilmore has, like, staked out space and is basically doing what Totally Biased tried to do of creating a space that is Black, but beyond that, for people who don't get to talk on TV a whole lot, it just gave itself the enormous challenge of having, like, I feel like the bits that they write for him are so fucking good. That round table is asking you to get up there and be snappy, funny, smart, and on point. And during the period of time when they were trying really hard to not just have traditional comedians on there, it was rougher, and I feel like it's gotten better since they have focused on comedians and figuring out the right way. Because, I mean, it's a television production challenge to understand what do you do. Because, like, one time I was on and with the mayor of Sacramento, and, like, how much you need to hold that guy's hand for what he's going to talk about so that he understands to be snappy. And the difference between that and being on with Janet Mock, who's a fucking media machine.
Yes.
And will look flawless and sound soundbitey and flawless, but also be human in any situation. Like, it was a world of difference.
To go back to Carson for a moment, I mean, one of the things I remember growing up watching him was that he would have occasionally the guest host. So Joan Rivers got to sit in.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone does that anymore. I don't know why. Like, why not bring in – I don't want to, like, contribute to a rumor mill, but there's been a lot of talk about Fallon and maybe a drinking problem. If that dude's got to go away to rehab for a little bit, why not bring in Louis C.K. to sit in for 2 weeks?
He would be amazing.
That's
he
what I'm saying. Amazing. I don't know why they don't do that.
He would be amazing because you can't – go ahead.
I think that it was just kind of destroyed by 87 to 92 of Joan Rivers first leaving for a different show. And then – Jay Leno basically making NBC put the pressure on Carson to leave. There's the fear of, will this person try to take my job? One of the lovely things about Chelsea, like, after I left, she got checked out enough that she would let people come on and guest host for a week and stuff. And it was fun. And I think really promotes that, like, cocktail party-ish sense of who knows what could happen. Like, Colbert's Halloween show delighted me so much. Like, there was, like, it was so good. There was this one segment. It was going to be like, trick-or-treaters come to the door. We've seen it on a late night show before. Mm-hmm. First of all, how beautifully his setup was to perfectly straight say that he had the answer for handling Jerusalem and go towards it until the ding dong. And, like, with Seth Meyers or Jimmy Fallon, I think there's a lot of sort of, like, Gen X-y, can you believe what I'm doing? I'm hosting a talk show. And, like, Stephen Colbert is like, I'm going to host a talk show and not behave as though I'm not or behave as though it's ridiculous and just do it with flawless aplomb. And then the bit was, you had trick-or-treaters come in, and then Rob Gronkowski in a full Master Chief uniform
comes in.
Because I love Rob Gronkowski, but it was a Halo integration. And, like, the beautiful way they did a Halo integration and called it out for what it was, but also made it alive and magical, is just such a warm reminder that if you try hard, television doesn't have to be terrible.
Yeah. No. Not at all. And I don't – the only thing that I think is a problem for the generation behind us is that I don't think young people are watching it. Like, I don't think kids watch – like, I watched Carson because I didn't have the internet at night.
Well, I was just reading about Trevor Noah's show that he's picked up, like, 10% more audience in non-TV platforms, like digital platforms. Okay. And I think that's where late night is moving overall, is that they're all trying to make those bits now that just light on fire and Facebook and Twitter and whatever. I mean, I feel like Jimmy Fallon has done a good job with that, with those like having him and Ariana Grande like do their little like
the
voice off.
Battles.
Yeah, the lip sync battles.
I never thought about it before, but the reason the monologue mattered in the 70s and 80s was because it was the thing you would say at the water cooler the next day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now it matters less because it is about forwarding a video.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why I don't watch late night as much, because I figured if there's a really good bit,
you'll
someone's going to post
the
next
morning.
Day. Exactly. So why stay up at 11:30 to do that as opposed to something
else? It's actually saving our lives.
Yeah, because when you sit and watch like all the whole – like I was trying to watch the whole show that Hillary Clinton was on for Stephen Colbert. And it's like you get restless. You get bored. It's like there's these down bits. Like you'd rather just digest it in these – I do, 10-minute bites or whatever.
I do love that Colbert has his weird second guess, like that he is just comfortable having an academic on to talk about their book about World War II.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does anyone here on a regular basis watch any of these shows, like on Hulu or on the internet, or do you just watch it in a clip-by-clip basis?
I watch like 2 or 3 Colberts every week, I would say. Maybe not like the whole thing, but I'll watch like the interviews that I want to see.
I put it on my DVR and then I go back if something in particularly funny happened, but I really just digest them in little small bites, whatever, if especially if somebody was on that I really liked or there was a performance that people are going crazy over.
Oh, here's one point that like we don't get as much stand-up comedy on late-night shows as we used to, but there's a weird way that Conan matters way more in my world than it does in the wider world because they essentially have the best comedy curation. Mm. Like on a lot of the others, the comic showing up is very infrequent, but like Conan is the one show that is committed to like – we're going to break new comics.
That's amazing. But why did Conan – I mean, you were bringing this up earlier. Why did Conan get the shaft? Why has he been just delegated to TBS after all this time holding it down?
Like – and he's – it's still such a good show. And you've got amazing writers. Hey, who here read the – was anyone here aware of Andre Debouchet's drunken Twitter meltdown about Prom King comedy? Were you guys not aware of this? So
recently?
This was like a couple of months ago.
Yes.
So, all right. The thing I should say at the beginning is I know all of these people and I am friends with all of these people. So it is a weird thing to talk about. But it is also public and it is about the thing that we are talking about. A writer for the Conan O'Brien program, Andre Debouchet, who is a very, very funny comic, tweeted making fun of At Midnight and saying you guys are all essentially playing Mad Libs.
Right. Okay. I do remember this.
And complained about Prom King comedy and sort of was saying comedy used to be this thing where outsiders used to yell at the establishment and now we've handed it all over to these cool kids. And that was very interesting and I respected it a lot. But it was also harsh because I love At Midnight and, you
so
know.
Diplomatic.
Yeah. Well, At Midnight has been so smart in getting the Twitter audience completely riled up for their show. I almost feel like the Twitter presence is like bigger than the show.
Right. They trend every night pretty much.
Well, I mean, they made a moment and they made a reason that you should watch it in real time.
Right.
Mm. And also, I've created the perfect amount of permeability between television and being a person watching. Because when you're watching, there's always that thing of, I know the answer to Jeopardy, or like, put me in, coach. And, like, having a show that says every night, if you have the funniest tweet in all of America, you're going to get to be on TV. And also, Hardwick is so good about being interactive with people.
Yeah.
Like, it really is a new, interesting model. And it's so funny to watch the ways that, because this is what I do for a living most of the time, the ways that people try to figure out other kinds of digital interactivity, and none of them are as simple as Twitter. Twitter is the thing that works. because it is about saying this is the one hashtag for today and we're all going to do it. And like working on shows where people would be like, we'll have four hashtags. It's like,
no.
You don't understand how this works.
But one show that we haven't talked about, which I don't know if this would can be considered the same thing, but it's the perennial favorite. It's SNL. And one of the things that I'm trying to understand where they're going, especially since they've had this dramatic cast change, but every year SNL sort of manages to get lull itself into like a comfort zone. And I think they might be getting there with this cast. I know they have Donald Trump on this week, but just sort of the gimme, the having Trump on, he's a major news source. He doesn't, you know, the Republicans are pissed off at the NBC folks. There's been just so much cloak and dagger, and to think that everybody wants him and he ends up not going, well, he was on Colbert, right?
I don't remember this.
Okay,
morning.
He was on Colbert, but he's going straight to here to sort of make news. And I feel like Saturday Night Live also has the opportunity to get into the news cycle that exists Monday through Friday.
And they understand that's how they get attention now. My worry for SNL is that it has now become too efficient a machine.
Yeah.
The fact that both of our NBC weekly late night shows come from 30 Rockefeller Center, from boys who used to be at the Weekend Update desk. Mm-hmm. It's dangerous because, like, Lauren is now such a good businessman that there isn't the same need or desire to cultivate good talent.
Right.
And there are many talented people who are on that show and many talented people who have gotten hired for a season and kicked off. But it is hard when he just goes and selects a new, bland, attractive Caucasian boy.
I mean, isn't that Seth Meyers in a nutshell?
Yeah.
I mean, as good of a writer as I think he is, and that's why I think he does have these 15-minute monologues, because that's how he can show off. He's like a really good, tight, comedic writer. But I just feel like he does not have the personality that I want to see on a late-night show.
Nope.
But
there's not something like generous about him. He's just not that person.
He's still so much better than Colin Jost. But you're right for that.
Colin Jost is cute.
Yeah, he's cute. That's what he's got. But Seth Meyers, it's one of those things where you can't help but feel that maybe he would be better served getting to run a sitcom.
Yes.
Or something like that where
he should be running something.
Yes, that personality.
Isn't documentary now his thing?
I know he's involved, but...
You know, he's executive producing.
Is he?
That.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great and really interesting point. Yeah, that's funny. Like, I feel like it is just that Dad has been taking care of you for so long, and Dad understands that this is a big, sweet cherry that makes him money and makes you money, so why not do this thing?
But we're going to be in a Lorne-less world at some point.
Yes.
And it's going to be real sad, but the reality is this can't go on forever. And none of these.
My assumption was always that Marcy Klein would eat his heart and then reincarnate as him.
We've just turned into a WTF episode. I just wanted to make this very clear to everyone. I mean, shouts out to Marc Maron. He's the man.
But wait, I still didn't get an answer to my question about Conan. Well, how did this happen?
Nobody can explain it.
Wait, what happened?
Just
did he get left out?
No, that he just got shafted
just that
so
he
hard.
He should have never done that documentary. He should have never done that documentary.
I think it's just Leno fucked him over, and then he wasn't a new story. I mean, even if he hadn't done the documentary, it would have been like, well, he tried at The Tonight Show, and it was only a moderate success. So
if you look back on it, it's been, 5 years maybe?
Yeah. Why do you think it was a huge mistake?
Oh, the documentary?
Yeah.
I just felt like it showed a side of him that people didn't really need to see.
Uh-huh.
And I felt like I liked him a little bit less because of that documentary. And I was with him 100% when all that shit went down. And then I saw the documentary. Then I was like,
Conan's always had this kind of darkness. There's always been like this dark edge to him. And I also think he was sort of crappy at interviewing women.
Well,
he did that whole pawing, purring thing at women
so often.
It is too much, though. You can do that for like a minute, and then you got to cut that.
It was his interesting answer to like Letterman flirtation, which got old in its own way. But there is something interesting about the fact that Conan is the only Lampoon guy who's gotten to be in front of the camera in like a big and major way. I never thought about that before, but he really is the only one. And part of it was that he cultivated nerdiness to the point that he did feel super, super approachable. Mm-hmm. Where, like, I mean, for cliche of a Harvard writery guy, Seth Meyers, who did not go to Harvard, feels more like that guy.
Mm-hmm. Like Bradley Cooper as Seth Meyers.
Right, exactly.
I mean, what about Jimmy Kimmel? We haven't even touched on old Jimmy.
Oh, I can sum Jimmy. We have to wrap. Well, just really fast, because I actually really like Jimmy Kimmel, but I think Jimmy Kimmel is a serviceable, formidable talk show host, late night host. I think he does what he's supposed to do. He shows up on time. He's
a consistently funny show.
Thank you.
He has a surprising amount of heart, which for when Kimmel first started, I did not expect to see that. It's like, you are kind of a softie.
The soft spot, him crying about Cecil the Lion, like that.
I don't know about that.
There's also,
I did.
There's
What's
also
wrong
something,
with Cecil?
There's something interesting about ABC just not having the same kind of late night comedy infrastructure.
Right.
And because even when he began, it was so you're going on after Nightline.
Right.
Is
he after or before?
I don't think Nightline exists anymore, but I don't know. When
Primetime Live, something.
Point is, I feel like he's one of those people who's been succeeding, but it was never a story that he was succeeding.
Something we didn't consider, I'm sorry, Colin, but I just have to consider this really fast, is the celeb power. You know how like certain talk show hosts have like their, like Oprah had her Jen Anisons and Julia Roberts and the Maya Angelous and the Tina Turners.
Right.
Jimmy's star power.
Yeah.
He's got, him and both Jimmy's have really good star watch. Like, well, they bring people in to do shit.
There's the thing of so much stuff.
Dance, monkey, dance.
So much stuff is in New York now. And there are just fewer guests in New York. Like, I worked on a talk show in New York, and booking is just not the same.
Right.
And I feel like Kimmel being around town, because the other things that are here are Corden and what other
Conan.
And Conan. And I feel like Kimmel's like out being sociable, and so is like actually being friends with these people in a way that Conan and Corden aren't. There is going to be a talk next week if you're in LA. It is moderated by Sarah Thayer, and it is women who know a lot about late night talking about women in late night.
Ooh.
And I'm going to go so hard, because when else do you get Meryl Marco and Molly McAleer and the women who know how this fucking machine works?
You've already said two people I love, so I'm there.
So if you're in LA and you care about this stuff, you should go. You are listening to Pop Rocket, and Colin says we have to stop because we've talked too long. We'll be right back after this to talk about our jams.
Jesse Thorne here. I'm taking Bullseye on the road in November. It's our world tour of several American cities. Get your tickets now while you can. They're going fast. Come see me and William H. Macy and Barney Frank and Tavi Gevinson, John Hodgman, the director of the Mutter Museum, who's going to do medical experiments on me, apparently, Ray Suarez, Dan Deacon, so many more. Music, comedy, and interviews at every tour stop. Go to bullseyetour.com to get your tickets. You will not want to miss this. If you're in Philadelphia, Boston, New York City, Washington, D.C., or our own great city of Los Angeles, California, bullseyetour.com to get tickets.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
Oliver Wang.
And every week we ask the question, what's your jam? Margaret Wappler, what's your current jam?
My current jam is from Julia Holter, who's an LA musician, and it's called Feel You, and it's from her fourth album, Have You in My Wilderness, and it's got some major, major Kate Bush vibes going on. I think her voice sounds really beautiful in this song, and this being her fourth album, it's interesting to see her trajectory. She started in this super experimental place and has kind of gotten more and more and more into the sunlight of like accessibility, and I think she's doing a really good balance here of it, like of being kind of having these experimental lush washes of synths come in and then also this like beautiful voice.
it's interesting when something is that light, but also that wall of soundy.
Yeah, totally.
Winner, what's your gem?
This song is called Kathy Lee by Jesse Lanza. It's dedicated to Kathy Lee Gifford because I think she's to blame for the Peanuts costumes for the Today Show last week because she might have spiked the punch when they were in the planning meeting. But I've heard this artist before. I'm not familiar, too familiar with her, but I've heard her in the context of probably like a W Hotel Lounge and or something that was like at a Trader Joe's or something. I don't know. But this, for some reason, this track specifically, it's brand new. I really like it. I think just like it. Kathy Lee.
I just want a robot version of Kathy Lee to come in here and dance now.
Like with like a jumpsuit on. Like a furly jumpsuit.
I'm feeling this. I'm with
yeah!
this. I kind of like it.
It's just hot, right? Quadrants. I'm just letting you know all fall you're going to get as a, from me to you, quadrants every week. Quadrant, quadrant, quadrant.
I'm ready.
And you
hit,
could totally
hit,
drop
hit.
Hotline Bling in the mix off of this.
Exactly.
Like, it'd be just bam.
Still
crush
knocks.
The crowd.
I tried so hard to like that song. Oliver.
You were into it.
Oliver, what's your jam? Oh, no, this song I was into. I'm talking about Hotline Bling.
Oh, okay, okay.
It is by a local L.A. artist named Low Leaf, and it's a song called As One from an album she put out last summer. So this is a bit of a late pass jam for me. From an album called, hopefully I can pronounce this correctly, Akashale.
So, Oliver, how did you learn about Low Leaf?
Oh, man. Here we go.
I'm sorry.
This song recommendation is sponsored by Lucky Strike.
I know, seriously. I actually discovered her through my friend Hua because he bought her album on Bandcamp, and I happened to follow his purchases. I mean, number one, she's sort of the artist that's kind of perfect for Bandcamp because it's a super indie, crunchy soul pop sound. I mean, I guess you could probably also hear her on something like KCRW. She sort of has that the KCRW vibe.
Oh, really?
But that said,
KCRW.
Yes,
oh,
yes,
okay.
I know.
You're not dissing on it now?
But Oliver,
yes.
If someone did want to hear more about you and Hua and your taste in music,
oh, yeah.
Would that be a possibility?
Well,
even?
I can combine a lot of different things. So number one, Hua actually just wrote a piece for The New Yorker about Bandcamp and about sort of music discovery in the 20-teens. That I think just came out in this week's issue, so check it out. Hua also happens to be my closest non-marital friend, and him and I are going to be in conversation at NYU this Thursday. So basically by the time this airs, it'll be tomorrow in New York at NYU. We'll be in conversation. And this is part of my East Coast book tour, in essence. I'll be at, let's see, NYU on Thursday. Let's see, Wesleyan on the following
Which
Monday.
Which bookstores?
Oh, this is going to be – it's not bookstores. These are all campus-related
oh, okay.
stuff. So then
cool.
It goes NYU, Wesleyan, Mount Holyoke, UMass Amherst.
Nice.
Oh, fun.
And it's all campus stuff. So – but yeah. So I discovered Low Leaf through him via Bandcamp. I just bought her album actually today, which I got the vinyl version. That's how much I liked. I never buy new vinyl because
oh, really?
New vinyl kind of sucks fidelity-wise. But for artists who I really like their albums, I will buy their album on vinyl. And it's just, again, it's from last year. I kind of slept and not – and this is like her, I don't know, third or fourth project. So she's been around in the L.A. area for quite a while, and it's just taken me now to listen to it. But I really, really love this album.
Oliver, it is testament to my deep love and affection for you that I listen to you when you talk about vinyl. Okay. So my jam this week is a brand new single – from an artist I think might just have what it takes to take it all the way. let's listen to her. Was this you being a little bit shady, Margaret Atwood?
I'm always shady. Shady is my middle name.
Oh, my gosh.
So I got to talk to the person I was most scared of talking to on the planet, my hero, Margaret Atwood, because, like, I got to host that episode of Bullseye for Jesse for, like, the swap around week. But when we were figuring out who I would do, I was like, what about Margaret Atwood? She has a novel coming out. And they were like, well, the timing doesn't work out for that episode, but we'd still like you to do it and just contribute it to the show because Jesse is the best. And so I got to talk to Margaret Atwood for, like, an hour and a half, and she was contentious as fuck. Like, she was pushing back and would not accept any question, but it was also...
She's a known tough cookie.
It was exactly the experience I would want. It was so, so magical, and it was really great, because, like, when you're dealing with an author whose works you love very much, there are so many questions you want to ask, and I asked a bunch of them, and she said, I won't answer that. That's not my job. You read the books. You decide what they're about.
Okay. Has this aired yet?
Yes, Oliver. It is airing this week. People are listening to it all around America as we speak, and I did at one point in time call her a witch. And she...
Did she cackle?
She cackled. It's Margaret Atwood. It's all she wants. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. We'll post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Azimizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Hello Kitty is definitely a lesbian. Hey, that is your name and we're going to read it. But we are not outing Japanese characters on this show. Pop Latte and Scar Thunder for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. Also, back to the 5-star reviews on iTunes. Please realize that we are currently in the process of organizing an extremely, extremely star-studded award show for the end of the year. And the one, like, listener category that will exist is best name from a 5-star review. Mm-hmm. So I want you guys to get on it and realize that there is a limited amount of time left, because come the end of the calendar year, you will be eligible for next year, and you will have to wait forever.
Mm-hmm. Better dazzle us.
Yep. Please get your 5-star reviews in today, and always remember, any 5-star review helps keep Margaret Wappler alive.
Thank you so much.
She's not out of the woods yet, guys.
Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. This week, tell us which website you visit the most. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the never has dressed up for Halloween, Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.